You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 70, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome along to the show. And as we do every 10 episodes or so, we're going to be looking at one of the Norse gods this time. In this case, the Norse god Hermod. Now, unfortunately, like many of the other minor Norse deities, there really isn't all that much written about Hermod in the Eddas. We have one major story which features Hermod prominently. In that regard, he's rather like Tyr, where you basically have one major story that he's a part of, and then you have just sporadic mentions in the lore thereafter. According to our friend Snorri Sturluson, Hermod was one of the sons of Odin. The myth in which he plays the most prominent role is the story of the death of Balder. And we covered that some time ago back on this show. You can go back and check out that story here. In that story, Odin loans Hermod the eight-legged steed Sleipnir. He rides into Hel to find Balder and ends up bringing Odin's ring Draupnir back to Odin with the message from Balder. And unfortunately, that's pretty much it. There really isn't a lot more to that story other than that. In other mentions in Norse lore, it's not really clear whether Hermod is supposed to be a god or perhaps a king who has become legendary. He is tied fairly strongly in the lore with the Norse hero Sigmund. It's even been suggested by some folklorists that Hermod is a later addition to the Norse pantheon and is perhaps based on the Greek god Hermes, who also visited the underworld, and who they would have been familiar with in the Norse lands because of their contact with the Romans. So as these things go, there's actually a fair amount of uncertainty about this character overall. In the Marvel Comics, Hermod came somewhat later than most of the other characters that we're familiar with. He wasn't introduced in the Thor comic until Thor number 274, which was published in August of 1978. He's appeared a number of times since then, I can't imagine in a very prominent role, but certainly has been part of several stories, including Thor number 294 and 295, Thor number 300 and 301. He made an appearance in The Avengers, number 249, and Thor number 350 through 352, and has kind of appeared very sporadically ever since. Most recently, he was seen in Marvel's Journey into Mystery, number 504 through 513. In the comics, Hermod is portrayed as the messenger of the gods. In other words, a whole lot like the god Hermes, in that he is one of the fastest of the Norse gods, and for that reason is often employed as a messenger. All right, so unfortunately, that's about all we have on Hermod, but let's go ahead and move along to our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar, you'll behold.
So as we mentioned a couple of episodes ago, we're going to be covering something relatively recent here, and for the next several weeks, we're going to be covering Thor Blood Oath, which is a 6-issue limited series Marvel put out back in 2005. And the first issue is cover dated November 2005, retail for $2.99, which is $4.25 in Canada. You know, I thought the exchange rate between the U.S. and Canada was actually a bit more equal than that, but I could be mistaken. And let's go ahead and do the credits first, because they're not actually on the first page. This was written by Michael Avon Oeming, I'm not sure how you pronounce this. Artwork is by Scott Collins. Dave Lamphere was the letterer. Will Quintana was the colorist. Laser, Schmidt, and Sitterson were the assistant editors. Tom Brevoort was the editor. Joe Quesada was the editor-in-chief. And Dan Buckley was the publisher. And we have a cover image here, shows Thor, looks like almost like he's stepping through a window, or perhaps a picture frame. The border kind of surrounding what he's stepping through is this beautiful Nordic sort of knotwork. It's very similar to Celtic knotwork, but a little bit more angular is the Norse tradition. And a kind of a fracturing skull grinning ominously off to one side, and Thor is stepping through with his arm athrust and his hammer in hand, which is shooting out little bolts of lightning everywhere, and he's got his left fist clenched, and beautiful cover, actually. And we open up to, it says, New York City many years ago, and we have a truly magnificent, actually, panorama of most of New York City. We see a smoky column rising up from Midtown Manhattan, and we move in closer, we see fire in the middle of the road. Of course, just being just like Thor to be in the middle of the road. And he's apparently buried under a big pile of burning rubble. And we see his hand thrust upward through the wreckage with Mjolnir in hand. And he's saying, Drug! And he shouts out one word, Creel! Ooh, and we know who this is. And we see him approaching the Absorbing Man. Yes, one of my favorite Thor villains, if not my favorite Thor villain. And we see Crusher Creel, the Absorbing Man. And he's attacking New York City in just beautifully detailed buildings. And you see even people in the windows. And he's absorbed the power of the steel and the stone. And he's grown really big. And he's really awesome looking, I have to say. And Creel is grabbing onto the walls and ripping down some of these buildings. He's got his ball and chain in his left hand. And he's smashing buildings with his right hand. And Thor is flying after him to attack him, and he's like, I hear you just fine, Winghead. No need to scream. Yet. I've absorbed the muscle of New York. Steel and concrete. You can't beat New York, you damned hippie. And Thor is whirling his hammer around and getting ready to strike it at the Absorbing Man. He says, The city's strength lies not in the streets or towering buildings, Creel, but in its people. You make my heart all mushy. Come on, Fancy Pants, hit me like a man. And Thor's like, I'll hit you like a god. One strike from my hammer, and he pulls himself short because he realizes that if his hammer touches Crusher Creel's ball and chain, he will absorb the power of Thor's hammer, and he doesn't want that to happen. So he allows the chain to wrap around him, and with an arg, Thor manages to keep this from happening, but it doesn't quite work because now he's wrapped in the hammer and the Absorbing Man is absorbing his Asgardian strength. And he starts whirling his ball and chain around like Thor would whirl his hammer. He's like, Hoo-yah, yeah, look at me now, little man, look at me now. And then Thor goes flying and flies into a building with a Krathoom. Take a drink. And he's like, Arg. And he has broken the chain on the Crusher Creel's ball and chain. And Creel comes after him. He says, Don't give up on me now, pretty boy. You just got me good and revved up. Break my chain, I'll break your... And he hears a sudden, really loud thunder from overhead. He's like, Ah, crud. And Thor's really pissed now. He has summoned a storm. And the storm is really whipping around Creel. And it's almost like a tornado. And picks up Crusher Creel and is dragging him up into the sky. Keep in mind that at this point in Marvel history, the way the Absorbing Man's powers operated is he absorbed the power of things around him. I think they later refined that to have a little bit more control of the ability, but in this case, he would just absorb whatever he was in contact with. So this is a good way to defeat him. And he's like, No! Don't do this to me! This ain't right! This is cruel! And Thor's, Speak to me not of cruelty, Creel. I have journeyed through ages of cruelty. I've witnessed deeds that would bring even you to tears. You are but a child with a temper. Look at me is what you say. And I say, yes, look at him, New York. Look at this giant, this man of steel and stone. See what his deeds have wrought. And he's beginning to get higher and higher and away from the city. And he starts to absorb the wind. And he is dispersing in this whirlwind that Thor has whipped up. And Thor is thinking to himself, I've scattered his atoms into the jet stream. Maybe he'll reform. And he'll have plenty of time to think about his return, if he ever does. And Thor's saying, Now that felt good. Ah, I shouldn't be reveling in my victory when so many are suffering because of it. And he looks down upon the city and see the path of destruction that Crusher Creole has created going through the city and shattered buildings and so forth. And Thor lands in an alleyway and he wraps his hammer on the ground. And he changes back into Dr. Donald Blake. And, so this places this to be well before the Walt Simonson era. And I think this is meant to actually take place in the 1960s, back before Thor had really fought the Absorbing Man that many times. And maybe this was supposed to be his first appearance. I'm not really sure. So he hears a voice and it's like, "Help, can we get some help over here?" And he's like, "Right here, ma'am, I'm a doctor." And he goes out in the street. And he really, now that he's Don Blake again, notices the true impact that this attack of the Absorbing Man has had upon New York. And he's looking very forlorn about all of this. We then shift scenes to a nearby hospital, and we have Dr. Don Blake, of course, and other doctors and nurses, including Jane Foster, who really appears to be more of a doctor here than a nurse. And it almost seems like some sort of twisted retcon here of what mid-60s Marvel Universe would have been. So we have Don Blake, and he's here with Nurse Foster, and he's wheeling a young boy into the emergency room, and he's like, "Jane, this kid has a compound fracture. More injured on the way." "What happened? It's a madhouse suddenly." "There was an event downtown." "Gee, I wonder what that event was." And the kid's like, "No, I'm telling you, it's good, man. I'll be fine. I'd be better now. Just give me some more time." And he's like, "You're brave, kid. But not that." And he uncovers the kid's legs, and they're scaly and they're like thorny. And so this kid obviously is some sort of a mutant. And as they watch his scaly, warty skin fades, it kind of goes back to normal. Jane is aghast. "Is this a joke, Donald? Because it's not funny." And he's like, "He's a mutant." And the kid's like, "Please don't tell." And they watch him as he runs away. So apparently he has some sort of mutant healing factor as well, since apparently he really doesn't have a compound fracture. We then cut to Jane and Don sitting in a cafeteria, and they're having kind of a philosophical discussion here. Jane's saying, "What a day! Craziness! This city's gone crazy, you know? The world's gone insane! People flying around the city! Aliens attacking! Creatures from the center of the earth. It's insane." And Blake is like, "Tell me about it." "It's like everything you know is wrong. It's like everything we know is wrong. That poor kid, so scared and confused over what he is, and to be hated for being born like that." And she reminds Don that there's a genetics conference coming up and suggests that the two of them go to this conference together. And Blake seems almost confused by the idea, and I was like, why would we want to do that? And she's like, "Well, you know, why not? Breakthroughs in genetics and the DNA chain look like they'll become part of our daily treatments in the near future. I also find it incredibly interesting. Think about this. Life sprung out of some ammonia and chemicals. They say a bolt of lightning might have set life off, creating the first single cell structure." And it doesn't look like Don Blake is really listening. And she goes on, and "Yes, lightning started life. That's what they say. Then the single cell split itself into two. It's not that different from the biblical story of Adam and Eve."
And this is really confusing because what she goes on to say.
"Before there was Eve, there was just Adam. Then God reached into him and made Eve from his rib, like the single cell splitting into two, just the way science says it happened."
Which is a bunch of bullshit because, you know, the biblical story of Adam and Eve is absolutely nothing like a single cell splitting into two. It's more like if you were to chop a piece off of a segmented worm and it would grow into another worm. Anyway, so we're moving on. You've shifted scenes again. He's in his apartment. He's trying to sleep, but he is troubled by his dreams. And in his dream, he's hearing thunder and a storm. I guess it's going on outside. And he's hearing a thooming noise coming from outside his door. And in his dream, he reaches for the doorknob and opens it up. And outside the hallway, it's all this huge glowing light. And it's all very poltergeisty. Or is that Close Encounters? I can never remember which one that is. He's thinking about his conversation with Jane that he'd had. And he steps out into a beautiful pasture. And then all of a sudden, there's these giant fracturing skulls, kind of like the one we saw on the cover, breaking up and falling from the sky. And they're going zoom, zoom all around him. And he's thinking to himself, science, religion, mythology. It's all been telling us the same thing, but it's like no one can see it. The truth is there for all of us to see now. Through genetics and DNA, we have the wisdom now to prove to the world that we all spring from the same beginning, and no one is greater or lesser than any other, be he man or mutant. We can stop the death, stop so much killing. And while this is going on, he is kind of stumbling through this forest of the falling skulls, and he sees the world tree, Yggdrasil. And you see this DNA strand almost carved into this tree. And if we see a figure who's hanging by his neck, and he's this figure from behind is his gray hair, and he's holding a scepter in his hand, and the body turns around, we see that it's Odin, and his guise is the Hanged God. And this is something we really haven't talked about much in our talks about the Norse mythology. But this is one of the aspects of Odin, the god who sacrificed himself to himself. And this is a parallel of the Christian mythology of Jesus sacrificing himself on the cross. It's really unsure whether this came first or whether this was influenced by Christianity. Because, of course, we know of Snorri Sturluson and his injection of some Christian ideas into the Norse mythos. But we see the hanged god. He opens his one eye and he points. And he points to the stakes where there are three skulls impaled. And we recognize them as the Warriors Three, the skulls of the Warriors Three. And mostly because the Hogun one is wearing its hat and the Volstagg one is wearing its hat. And they have the facial hair stuck to them of the Warriors Three. And I'm pretty sure that skulls don't decay that way. But they had to make sure that Don Blake knew who he was looking at. We then cut back to New York City, and Don Blake wakes up, and he feels as though his brothers are calling to him. The Warriors Three are calling to him, and he goes up in the rainstorm to the roof and bangs his hammer on the roof with a giant foosh, changes into Thor, and we see Thor standing there whirling his hammer about, and he goes flying off to Asgard, and we see him flying over the Rainbow Bridge, and of course the Golden City in the background, and it's all glowing and as like a sunset behind us. Absolutely phenomenal artwork here on this page. He's still thinking about what Jane has told him, and he is thinking to himself, Jane's words echoed within my dream. I'm not sure if her words created the dream, or if the dream was created by our talk. Either way, I sense I'm called home by it. I really love the sight of Asgard from here. And he lands on the Rainbow Bridge, and Heimdall's there, guarding the Rainbow Bridge as he always does. It's like, ho, Thor, how does the favorite of Odin fare? I fare well, Heimdall, but I fear all is not right in Asgard. That it is not, old friend. Thy feelings are true. The Warriors Three are on trial at Thingvellir. On trial? What for? Murder. And Thor looks all shocked by this. And we then shift scenes again. And we shift scenes to the Thingvellir. Now we have Thor. He's arriving on the scene. And we see sitting on the high seat is, of course, Odin. To Odin's right are all the gods. And standing in the middle, in sort of a ring of fire, are the Warriors Three, and then Hogun, Volstagg, and Fandral. And on Odin's left, there's a large group of giants. Thor's angered to see the giants there, and he's thinking to himself, giants! Giants and gods! Ugh, I should fly down from there and smite them in the old way with my hammer. But I'll listen first before I go crazy and roll heads. And Odin stands up before the crowd. And this is Odin when he still had two eyes. So places it well before the Simonson Thor era. And he has, of course, he got this really elaborate tabard that he's wearing and a really elaborate headdress. It's nice to see that Scott Collins is kind of keeping in the Kirby tradition of having these really elaborate clothes we'll probably never see again. And Odin says,
gathered we are at the Althing today, a place of judgment and law, laws which we must all obey. We are compelled. No blood shall drop upon the soil, or my punishment shall be swift and merciless.
And Volstagg says, it must be our blood, and he gets hushed by Odin, and it's like, don't.
Fandral, Thogon, and Volstagg, collectively known as the Warriors Three, are here under the name of murder. It is not a question of charge nor evidence, but of confession.
And Thor is looking really shocked. And all these other people in the crowd, they look aghast at this confession that they'd made. So here we have kind of a flashback of what happened, and we see that, you know, the Warriors Three are on this tiny little boat. It looks like practically a rowboat here, and they're standing up in it, which can't be great for its stability. And there's this giant whale-like thing splashing. It's this huge, enormous waves. And Odin is narrating here.
In the North Sea, the Three did hunt, and a giant beast had caught their eyes. This was no wee thing, but a gigantic thing that could have easily have crushed their small ship, leaving them to the mercy of the sea god Njord, or his lack of it.
So they're hunting, and Hogan has this giant harpoon in his hand, and Volstagg's in the middle, he's eating chicken, and Fandral's in the back, he's got like a mug of ale, he looks like, he's like saying, come on, brother, is it not big enough a mountain for you to spear? And Fogan's like, well, you certainly are, you bragger. And all of a sudden they are swamped by a giant wave, which knocks Volstagg's chicken out of his hand, and that's what he really cares about. It's like, oh, by the gods, my chicken! But he takes the harpoon, and he reaches out for Hogan, and Hogan grabs him back on board, and Hogan's like, thanks, fat man.
I was saving the spear, not you, wet goat. Spill my chicken! My mother cooked that specially for this trip, and for that foul beast thou shalt pay!
And we see Volstagg driving the spear deep into this whale thing with a roar. And Odin's like,
the Three harpooned the beast, knowing not that it was the shape-shifting giant Hulth, too dull to shift out of his own form. His unchanged body fell to the bottom of the sea. Verily, his true being never known to the Three until the calling of Hulth's father, Knives.
That's Knives, that's G-N-I-V-E-S. And we then call him to the stand, or as it were, and Knives has his say here.
That night my son's very soul came calling for revenge from the sea. I divined with the magic all-seeing skull of my father's what ill fate met he. Now I shall call upon the gods at Althing, that justice be met. I call upon the price of a weird to satisfy our family blood.
To keep the truce between us, the Three have agreed to come to the Althing and fall under judgment. These Three may have killed in ignorance, but they are men of honor, men of words and deeds.
And Volstagg is like, 'tis death for all of us.
By the laws laid down by gods and giants who are bound by these ways, I name the price for my son's murdered life. And that price be...
And we hear a crack-a-cack-a-cack of lightning. And Thor is angry, and he is there, and he's like,
I shall not stand idly by as the fate of my brothers lies at the hands of a giant. I say thee nay. I would lay your bodies to waste first, to Hela with the laws.
And Odin's not real happy here with Thor. He says,
you know the law, boy. Do not force mine hand. As I have made you, I shall unmake you.
And the giant here is laughing hysterically. Thus,
ha, ha, I say, this is wonderful. Fret not, Allfather. Today is not the day you shall end the life of your son. Sweat not thy brow, Odin, son, god of thunder, holder of the winds and lightning. Your fellows shall not face death on this day, but now you have linked your fate to theirs.
And Thor's like, yeah, whatever. And we get a little bit more speech from the giant.
My beloved son, Hulth, was a dolt. My son, yes, but a dolt as well. What can a father do? I tried yelling, beatings, humiliation, magic, yet still, his mother and I disowned him long ago. He was stupid, an embarrassment, and ugly. Did I mention he was useless? In fact, I'm glad he's dead.
And you see the reaction from the crowd of the Asgardians and all these shocked faces. And you have what looks like Brunhild here, one of the Valkyries, and we just have Baldur.
Collins here has drawn a really nice variation on Baldur's traditional outfit. I think it looks pretty awesome.
And I'm not sure who these other people are, but they look cool, whoever they are.
However, I love having your four lives wrapped around my finger. So having unlawfully killed my child outside of the battlefield or a rightful challenge, I'm calling on you to collect my weird here at the Althing.
And we have Thor standing there. Looks like he's about ready to strike. We hear a voice, and it's Baldur here, and he says, but the price must be agreed upon by all, Lord Knives.
Verily, you shall agree to this. The price I ask for my son's life, for his value to our family and for our honor is simple. 3 apples, the skin of a pig, a spear, a sword, and 3 shouts to be delivered on a hill when the task is done. That is all.
And we see kind of hiding behind everyone here is Loki. And in this comic, Loki is a sort of drunken sot. I mean, he's sitting up here and drinking out of a horn, and he's got like wine running down his face, and he looks drunk. And so there's like, go ahead, do it. I'm sure there'll be no strings attached, idiots. And Volstagg is the first to speak up, and he's like,
done! In truth, we have most of that on hand!
And Baldur's like, shut your mouth, you fat child!
The giant's like, too late! The accursed have accepted. According to our laws, there shall be no need to deliberate.
And then he gets more specific with his conditions. He said,
3 apples from the loftiest branches of Yggdrasil, the world tree. These are not unlike the apples of Idun, as they can cure any wound and return a man from the dead, yet do not grant immortality. The apples are guarded by a giant eagle who will tear you to bits and pieces, and he will not let you have them. The skin of the pig comes from Olympus and belongs to Dionysus. The pig is magical, and when he walks in rivers, they are turned to fine wine. The pig is guarded by Hercules, and he will not let you have it. The spear is on Midgard, in Ireland. It is called Slaughter, and it is kept in a cauldron of blood, for it is so angry that only blood can cool its killing fervor. It belongs to Cúlan, Ur's greatest warrior, and he will not let you have it. The sword I want is called Grasscutter, and it lives in the Far East. It belongs to the dead, and they will not let you have it.
So it sounds like all these things are not likely to be given up easily. And the three warriors, Threer and Thor, are looking there, is like, and Loki's like, told you so. And then we finally find out the last condition from the giant. He says,
but wait, the last task be the hard one. I want you to go to the tomb of Thoth. It is guarded by his 3 warrior sons, whose sole purpose is to keep the tomb silent. They will not let you call there. These things must be brought back to the Jotunheim, or a great loss of honor will befall the Aesir, and the giants will prove their betters. Should they fail, as we believe they will, then death shall come justly to them. Should they prevail, then honor and peace will fall over the Aesir and Jotunheim. Death is the only option for failure.
And we have, once again, the Asgardians, like, well, one of the goddesses, like, base villain, you said you would not claim such a price.
This is but another form of death, a mocking one at that.
Vidar, though Thor be your true brother, you must stand aside the law. This is the way of things.
If the price is too steep for the gods, perhaps I can find something easier for them.
And that gets Thor all angry. He's like, we gods can best any task you mark, giant. My brothers are no base murderers. It was but an accident. All eyes see that but yours. Twist the law if you dare, but we Aesir shall prevail.
And he's like, even without thine hammer? Use it not in fighting, and you can take it with you. Otherwise, leave it behind. It would be unfair to take the greatest weapon of the gods with you, would it not?
And Odin is pronouncing his judgment here. It says,
then so be it written by the Nords. The warriors Three and Thor shall journey on these tasks for the wearing price of Knives' son. Should they fail, death shall fall upon them, and shame upon us.
And we then shift scenes to some time later, where we have Thor and the warriors Three. They're on horseback, and they're riding out of town. And Fandral is kind of castigating Volstagg for speaking up during the trials. Thy mouth may actually surpass thy girth in size. Even after Odin himself sewed it shut, you had to go on and blather on without thinking.
Ho! And whose idea was it to be hunting in the North Sea?
Lo, if I were to disguise myself as a giant sea lion and get harpooned, I surely would have spoken up. Like, hold, thou shalt stop stabbing me, as I be not a monstrous sea lion, but a big old stupid giant. So stop killing me, lest it cause an interpanthonic incident. Thor says, you know, shut up, everybody, and they hear a little bit of thunder, crack a crack a crack, and Volstagg is like,
my apologies, my lips be still. I tend to talk too much when I'm hungry.
But you're always hungry, says Hogan.
And hence the talking too much. I said I was sorry.
And Fandral says, Then be quiet, if being quiet is thy vow.
Given the chance, I would. But you fellows keep talking to me.
And we have this sort of lighthearted banter and bickering as we close out the story.
And Thor's like, oh, Hela, kill me now. And that's the end of the issue. Now, what can I say about this? Now, very mythic in the structure and so forth of the story. Love this the story. One of the things, though, I don't like about it is very wordy, very conversational. That's hard to talk about in a review. It's hard to act out. I mean, you can act it out, but it just is not real convincing as far as I'm concerned. Still, I really like the characterization that's going on here. I love the fact that we have Loki there, and for once he really isn't the bad guy of the story. He's just sort of skulking in the background, being drunken and unpleasant, and it's a rather different take from what we normally see about Loki. And I really love the artwork by Scott Collins, and every page of this is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, whether it's, you know, fighting the absorbing man in New York City, to this, you know, scene at the All Thing, the All Father, surrounded by gods and giants, and this incredible detail everywhere. You really almost couldn't have two scenes that were so completely different from each other, yet Scott Collins manages to make this really work. Overall, just really, really fantastic artwork. It reminds me in some places of Craig Russell. And I know that might seem odd because it's really, I don't think, one of his main influences, but I can definitely see it in the style that he's doing it. I also see a lot of Charles Vess, and particularly in his portrayal of Loki, it looks very much like a Charles Vess character. Very different look from anything that we're used to seeing. And one of the other artists that I'm seeing a little bit of influence here would be Glenn Fabry, who drew Thor Vikings. I certainly see that in the facial features of various characters, as well as the enormous amount of detail that's being put in here, though obviously we don't have as gory of subject matter as we would with something that Glenn Fabry would be drawing. I've been aware of Scott Collins as an artist for quite some time. He did some work on the Legion of Superheroes in the late 90s, and even in the early 90s was doing some work on some of the books that I was reading at the time. Now, there are a few little nitpicks that I have about Scott Collins' art, and I'll be talking about them as we go forward, in particular the way he draws faces. But we'll be talking about that as we go forward in the series. All right, so with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. Yes, this is going to be another short show. We're going to have several of them in a row now because I am still trying to get a backlog of shows. Last week, I had to go to Ohio, and of course, that got me back on schedule as far as the shows that I already had in the can. And I promise that once my vacation is over, we'll go back to having a more normal length episode. And that is, of course, unless people really like the shorter episodes. I kind of enjoy doing the shorter episodes because that means that I go through the material less quickly. But also, it gives me a little bit of a breather between episodes that I wouldn't always have. All right, so with that being said, thanks very much for listening. Once again, you can email the show. The email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. So, from Chicago, Illinois, this is Tom Harris. We'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard.